So you can make your way there as you do. For those who weren't with us last week, we celebrated last week with a special children's ministry service. It was wonderful. We had a lot of carols. We had the kids up here. They gave us a special presentation as well. And we started our festive season series, if you will, called Joy to the World. And what we are going to do over this season is look at the verse or the lines of the song Joy to the World, the Christmas hymn. And we looked last week at the first two lines, Joy to the World, the Lord is come. And Joy to the World, the Christmas hymn, was actually written by an English writer by the name of Isaac Watts. And he originally printed it in 1719. That's before I was born, eh? That's a fair while ago. But it was printed with a collection of writings called, get ready, it's not short, The Psalms of David, imitated in the language of the New Testament and applied to the Christian state of worship. And the song itself and the lyrics for the song itself were inspired by Psalm 98, Psalm 96, verses 11 to 12, and Genesis chapter 3, verses 17 to 18. In the second passage of the Psalms there, Psalm 96, verses 11 to 12, if you go there in your own time, you'll note that the psalmist, David, actually calls to the nations to rejoice. Not just Israel, but the nations to rejoice. Why? Because of God's faithfulness to Israel in bringing his Messiah, in bringing the Savior. The Lord is come. Because as we learned last week, Jesus, God in the flesh, stepped out of his realm and into ours. He fulfilled the messianic prophecies. He is the Messiah. He is the promised one for the line of David. And thus the fulfillment of God in sending Jesus Christ. But he is also the Savior, not just of Israel, but of all mankind. And that's a glorious thought, right? That God became a man and dwelt with us. God lived with us. Emmanuel, God with us. That's why we celebrate Christmas. The Lord is come. And today, we're going to pick up on the next line of that song that goes, let earth receive her king. So, Matthew chapter 2 we are in. So you can look at that with me. All of things back on. Wonderful. There we go. Matthew chapter 2, we are looking at the first 12 verses of that chapter today. So you can read along with me as we go through, starting at the top of verse 1. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, the days of Herod the king, Magi from the east arrived at Jerusalem, saying, Where is he who is born king of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. When King Herod heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Gathering together all the chief priests, the scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They said to him, In Bethlehem of Judea, this is what has been written by the prophet. And you, Bethlehem, land of Judea, are by no means least among the leaders of Judah, for out of you shall come forth a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod secretly called the Magi and determined from them the exact time the star appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, Go and search carefully for the child. When you found him, report to me, so that I too may come and worship him. After hearing the king, they went their way, and the star, which they had seen in the east, went on before them until it came and stood over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. After coming into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell to the ground and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned by God in a dream not to return to Herod, the Magi left for their own country by another way. So of all the biblical narratives that the world knows, it's quite popular. This one here is probably one that most people will know, but it's probably the one that's shrouded in the most myth. As we read through it then, you might have been thinking of the old Christmas tale that we know, Jesus born in a manger and then the wise men come. And you're probably thinking, well, I didn't know some of these things. Well, this is different to what I've heard and understand. Because like I said, there's a lot of myth and a lot of tradition that has built up over the years around this story. Now, we're not going to take the time to go through all of those today, because I don't want us to lose sight of what we're looking at. Let earth receive her king. But we will pick up on some of those as we step through, because they're necessary for what we're looking at. And the first one is, you'll note there, it does not appear that the events that we just read in Matthew chapter 2 actually happened on the night of Jesus' birth. These wise men, these magi, don't actually come on the very night that Jesus was born. Why can we say that? Well, verse 11 says, after coming into the house, they saw the child with Mary. Now, when we go back to the story, when we go back to Luke's gospel, which we did last week, where was Jesus born? He wasn't born in a house. He was born in a manger. And why? Because there was no room in the inn. People from everywhere were going back to their places of birth for the census. So Joseph and Mary had to go back to Bethlehem, and there was no room in the inn. There was no room in the city for them to stay. So they had to go into this stable where Mary gave birth. Yet these magi meet Jesus in a house. Not to mention that Matthew, at the very start of his gospel, very clearly says, now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea. So these events are happening after that night, and it's very likely it's a good several months after that night. Because it's most likely that the star in the east these magi saw came up on that night. Then they started traveling, and that would have taken them some time. It's interesting to note as well that after Matthew says this was after the time that Jesus was born, he then, in terms of what we're looking at today, points out something significant. He points out that Israel already had a king. They already had a king. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, Israel had a king, Herod. Herod the Great, as he was known. But he wasn't the greatest king, if we're honest. He was good, diplomatically to a degree. He was good economically to a degree. He did some wonderful things for the city itself and for the people at the time. He was a good warrior. So I guess a good representation for them in that sense. But as a person, as a character, he was, well, shocking, to say the least. Herod the Great was a cruel and a merciless person. So much so that when he was on his deathbed, he had all the significant individuals in Jerusalem arrested and put in prison, with a special mandate made that when he died, those people were to be executed. Why? Because he did not think that people would weep for him when he died, and he wanted weeping in Jerusalem when he died. He got it. Because they weren't weeping for him. That's cruel. I mean, that's wicked. How depraved and evil can you be? And yet, if you read the rest of chapter 2, you'll see here, he can be even more depraved and even more evil than that. He was not a good king. But not only was he not a good king as a person, not only was he not a good representation for Israel as a person, he was not even a legitimate king. He was not even Jewish. He was not from the line of David. He was not Jewish. King Herod was an Edomite, and he only sat on the throne because Rome had put him there. And Rome was not even the legitimate rulers of the land. They came in and took it over. The only reason they had authority in Israel, because of their military might. And thus they put Herod on the throne because it served their purposes. And that's why it's significant that these magi stroll into town and they start asking the question, where is the one born King of the Jews? They're not looking for Herod. They're not looking for the guy in charge here. They couldn't care less about Herod. He's not Jewish. He's not born the King of the Jews. He might be the king in terms of his title given to him by the authority at the time, but he was not the true king of Israel. He was not the one they were looking for. That would have been quite insulting, considering the man that Herod was. That was a pretty dangerous question to ask. Where is the one born king of the Jews? In other words, where is the real king? Where is the true king of Israel? And it wasn't that they asked at once. In fact, the context there is that present participle gives the emphasis that this was a continual asking. They didn't ask the first person they see and then just assume they'd take them to wherever they needed to go. When they didn't get the answer they wanted, they asked the next person, and the next person, and the next person. They continued to ask. They're in the Jewish capital. There's a whole bunch of people that live in Jerusalem, and they wanted to know where the real king was, so they asked everyone they could to find out. The assumption is twofold. Number one, that the people of Israel knew that Jesus was born. Secondly, that they knew the significance of who Jesus was and his title. You know, unfortunately, it didn't seem to get the answers they wanted. We know they asked around because in verse 3 it tells us that not only was Herod troubled, but all Jerusalem was greatly troubled with him. They were rocked to their inner being. Now this isn't surprising. I mean, Israel at that stage really was a religious and a political power king. You had Rome who was in charge, again, only because of their military might. You had zealous Israelites and zealous Jews that were had been and will continue to uprise and try and overthrow this Roman yoke. The problem is, if Rome gets a whiff of that, they're going to step in and wipe Israel out. But if the Israelites get enough people and enough zeal up, they'll start stepping in and think they can do it. And whatever way it works, there's going to be civil war. There's going to be bloodshed. So it really was a religious and a political powder keg ready to blow. Not only that, for Herod, as I mentioned, this comment, this question would have been a great insult and would have brought with it great fear and dread to him. He knew he was the illegitimate king. He knew he wasn't there by birth. He knew he was there purely by his wit and by the pure luck and great maneuvering he had done to allow Rome to have him there. If there was a real king, if there was a legitimate king born, then that threatens his position and his power. False kings don't get treated nicely on most occasions. So Herod was not only greatly troubled, he would have been greatly fearful and greatly worried. And, as we find out, also very antagonistic and very hateful. You see, in his efforts to discover this unknown king, this unknown baby, we see a demonstration of this fear and this hatred and the great trouble in this man. As I mentioned, you read through the rest of chapter 2 of Matthew's Gospel, you'll see that Herod actually orders the slaughter of all male children 2 years old and younger, not just in Bethlehem, but also in the surrounding areas. I mentioned this man was wicked, and he truly was. Yet the hatred of this false king, interestingly, also gives testimony to the reality that Jesus is the true king. Jesus is the true king. So worried was Herod that these magi were right, that he did everything he could in his power to stop the true king coming. But of course he couldn't. He couldn't. The magi, however, weren't too interested in Herod's plans. They had a plan of their own. And unlike tradition, the magi, the wise men, were not kings themselves. They were not kings themselves. They were, in fact, kingmakers. We hear from Matthew that they've come from the east. And they're, in fact, from the region of Persia. These people, as we understand from the book of Daniel, were among the highest-ranking officials in Babylon, in the kingdom and the courts of Babylon. They were the top. In fact, you go through the book of Daniel, you'll see Daniel himself actually becomes the top, the guy that looks after this group of people, which could very well be the reason why they know about the special born king of the Jews. But they were high-ranking people who coronated kings. They were kingmakers, not kings themselves. Yet here, they had traveled a great distance to recognize a king that they would not coronate, and a king who was far greater than any king they would coronate. And they'd come with one purpose, not to help Herod, not to help Israel, not to get rid of Rome and free them from oppression. They came to find the one born king of the Jews so that they could worship him. That was their sole focus and purpose. So, naturally, seeing his star in the east, they knew he was born. So where do they go? They go to Jerusalem, the capital. Why not? Where else would a king be born but the capital city, where the temple is? That's where they go. It's also interesting to note that we never get told that the star actually led them to Jerusalem. They say, we saw his star in the east, in verse 2, but there's no mention of the star actually leading them there. In fact, if the star had led them to Jesus in the first place, they wouldn't have gone to Jerusalem. So it suggests the star didn't lead them. They just saw the star, they knew he was born, they went to Jerusalem because it seems a logical place to go. But when they get there, they can't find him. No one knows where he is. The star does eventually lead them, but it doesn't tell us that till verse 9. That's when it reappears. That's after they've been to Jerusalem. That's after they've met with Herod. And that's after Herod sent them to Bethlehem to go and find this child. It's important that the star meets them there, because where in Bethlehem do you go? It's like me sending you to Derby to go and find a baby. Oh, it's in Derby. Just go up there and find it. It might be a small town, but I tell you what, you're going to have a whole lot of time trying to find an individual baby in a town like that. And so God sends them. Note also something interesting here before we get to the rest of that. Verse 4, if you have a look at that for a minute. They've come around, they're asking, where is the one born king of the Jews? Herod gets wind of them, he calls them, they come and see him. And then Herod, wanting to know the truth as well, he wants to find out where this person is. Obviously he wants to kill him, but he gathers the religious leaders. He gathers the people in the know, the chief priests, the scribes, I mean the Pharisees, the Sadducees, those kind of men. He gathers them together and he doesn't ask where's the one born king. He asks where the Messiah was to be born. It's interesting. The Magi never mentioned the Messiah, did they? I mean, they just said king. The word Messiah is a Hebrew word meaning the anointed one or the chosen one. Now the Greek equivalent is Christos or Christ, and we learned last week that means king. So we could say, well, it's just different words meaning the same thing. And in essence, yes, but Christ and Messiah is a very specific king, a very specific individual. But here we see that a non-Jew in Herod has connected that the one born king of the Jews is the Messiah, is the promised one of Israel, is the promised one from the line of David, is the promised Savior and King that God had sent to Israel hundreds of years ago he was going to send. He's made that connection without anybody helping him at all. Herod may not have been a Jew, but he was certainly familiar with Jewish customs and belief. So the understanding here that the King of the Jews is the Messiah that all Israel had been waiting for. Hence the worry for King Herod. 2 Samuel chapter 7, you can read all about the covenant that Jesus makes with David. It says in verse 12, I will raise up your descendant after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. Verse 13, he says, I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. The one born king of the Jews is the one who fulfills the covenant that God made with David. Jesus fulfills the covenant that God made with David. I always forget the first things. Not only does Jesus fulfill that, but if you look on the, you look on the table there, you'll see that both his earthly mother and his earthly father lines come from the line of David. So whatever way you look at it, Jesus fulfills all the messianic prophecies. He fulfilled them in his line, he fulfilled them in his first coming, in the events surrounding his birth, the virgin birth, where he was born, what happened, down to the very word, the very T, and the very time. This was Israel's true king. This was the one born king of the Jews. This really was the Messiah. The problem was, he was not the king that the Jews had in mind. The Jews wanted the Messiah. The Jews wanted their king, but they wanted a political king. They wanted a military king. They wanted someone to come in, kick out Rome, and set up Israel. God had a bigger plan. He needed to deal with the spiritual issue first. That's why Jesus came, the Messiah, meek and mild. That's why he was born in Bethlehem, in a manger. That's why he was born a child. Bethlehem is where he was born, according to the prophet. Bethlehem is where the Messiah would be, as the religious leaders told Herod. So Bethlehem is where the Magi were sent. Off they went. As I said, they didn't know where in Bethlehem to go find him, and neither did the scribes and the Pharisees. So that's why King Herod says, go and search carefully for the child in verse 8. Find out whereabouts he is in there. And when you find him, come and tell me, so that I may go and worship him as well. Obviously, deception there. But the real interesting thing about that, as I mentioned, the star now reappears and directs these men directly to the house where Jesus was. I think God is giving us a theological lesson that he gives us throughout Scripture. that God does not leave those who truly seek him to stumble around in the darkness. Those whose hearts are seeking after him will be led directly there. And so it was with these men. The star reappears. And have a look at verse 10 for a minute. Look at the reaction of these men. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. It's like Matthew's at a loss to describe the great joy that these men had. So he kind of uses two of the same words twice. It's like they were really, 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 really excited. Exceedingly with great joy. I can't give you enough superlatives there to tell you how excited these men were. They were stoked because they realized they were going to meet this king. They had a very unique and a very strong interest in this particular man, the one born king of the Jews. And that unique interest is shown in their response to him. Have a look at verse 11 with me. When you see godly people who find Jesus, generally they all respond the same way. There's little nuances that are different. Obviously, these men were slightly different in terms of how they did things, but the general consensus is the same. Look at that. After coming into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, then they fell to the ground and worshipped him. People who are truly seeking God find him. What do? They worship him. That is the natural and that is the proper response to God of a redeemed heart. They worship him. And note that Matthew is very, very careful here to make sure that you understand that they are worshiping the child. They are worshiping Jesus, not the mother, not Mary. He's gone to great pains to point that out to us. They see Mary, but they don't worship her. He says very carefully, they fell to the ground and worshiped him. Why? Because only he is the one worthy of their worship. Only he is the one worthy of their adoration. Only he is the one in that room who is God incarnate. Only he is the true king of the world. And then, worshiping him, prostrated before him, they get up and they open their treasuries and they give him gifts. Again, Matthew is very clear that the gifts are presented to him, not to Mary, not to Joseph. The gifts are presented to Christ. And that's important to note because the gift giving isn't an addition. It's not something new to what they're doing. The gift giving is just another facet of their worship. It's a continuation of that, if you will. It's a part of their worship. So they continue to worship God, continue to worship Christ by giving their gifts to Christ. Now that's not to say that Mary and Joseph couldn't use those gifts for the family's good. As the parents, that's their prerogative, that's their duty, that's their responsibility. And let's be honest, what does a child have to do with myrrh, gold, and incense? So the parents could use it, however the gifts were not given to them, they were given to the child because he is the one who is worshipped. We can see that the gifts there are very significant. Before we do see that, I want to point out something else to you as well here. Is that right giving always comes out of right worship. Right giving always comes out of right worship. And I think that's important for us to recognize and remind ourselves of this time of the year. I mean, we can get caught up in the giving, can't we? And sometimes we can go too far the other way and chuck it out the window because, oh, it's all materialistic, it's all worldly. But right giving comes out of right worship. You can give generously. You can give abundantly. But it's not if it's not done with a loving heart and a relationship with God, then your giving's empty. Right? I mean, look at these men. They did give graciously. They did give abundantly. They did give expensive gifts. But it came from a heart of worship. It came from a submission to Christ, a desire to see him glorified. It came out of great exceeding joy at finding the one born King of the Jews. It came out of a heart of worship. Right giving always comes out of a right heart. It always comes out of a heart of worship. Remember, what they gave this child was significant as well. Now, in the last few festive seasons, we've been through those gifts specifically on both of those last two occasions, so I won't go too much into detail for you this year. just for those that haven't been with us, and we'll briefly run through them, because one of those is significant for what we look at today. I'll go through them backwards. Let's start with myrrh. Myrrh is an embalming incense used to embalm dead bodies. It's an odd thing to give a child, isn't it? The myrrh represents Jesus' sacrificial death. This is the reason he was born, so that he would die, right? Frankincense is a resin that comes from a plant and is used to make incense, very sweet-smelling incense. And back in the Old Testament, God actually prescribes frankincense in particular worship within the temple. And so here, frankincense represents Christ's position as the great high priest. His position, his title, is mediator between man and God. And then, of course, more significantly for us this morning, was the first gift, that of gold. Now, throughout history, gold has signified great treasure and great value. It's been a representation of nobility and a representation of royalty. And here, the gold represents Jesus' title and his right as king. He was given gold, a present fit for a king. Because he is the legitimate king of the Jews. He is the one born king of the Jews. And it's not just the Magi that knew that. Mary knew that. Joseph knew that. Because they had already been told. They'd been told before he was even born. Angel Gabriel told Mary in Luke chapter 1, verse 32 and 33, he said, the Lord will give him the throne of his father David. He will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and his kingdom will have no end. In short, your child is the Messiah. He is the one born king of the Jews. That should be a question, though, of us. This guy might be the one born king of the Jews. He might be Israel's promised Messiah. He might be everything that the Magi thought he was. But why, then, did these men, these high-up officials, intelligent men, travel all the way from Persia to Bethlehem in Judea to come and find and worship a king that isn't theirs, from an entirely different nation and group of people that they have nothing to do with? Well, I think the answer is that these wise men, these Magi, understood something about Jesus that his own people didn't quite grasp at the present point in time. That Jesus wasn't just king of the Jews. Jesus was actually the king of the earth. In fact, the Bible tells us the king, or rather, Jesus is the king of kings and the Lord of lords. He is the top king. He is the king of all the other kings, which means he's the king of all the nations. King of kings and Lord of lords. Paul says it to Timothy in 1 Timothy 6, verse 15. He says that he who is blessed and only sovereign, the King of kings and Lord of lords. Revelation chapter 17, pointing out that Jesus will defeat all the forces of evil. Says it's because he is the Lord of lords and the King of kings. Revelation 19, verse 16, notes that at the second coming of Christ, he will come, and on his robe and on his thigh, he has a name written, King of kings and Lord of lords. Jesus is not just the King of Israelites. He's the King of kings, the Lord of lords. He is the King of the earth. He's earth's king. And the Jews did recognize that at one point. Well, they did recognize him as the Messiah. And as he entered into Jerusalem a week before they crucified him, they entered him coronating him as king, waving palm branches, putting clothes down before him and shouting, Hosanna to the Son of David! And unfortunately, as we've seen for those who've been walking through John's Gospel with us, their faith, their belief was shallow and superficial. When Jesus didn't live up to the standards of the king that they wanted, that they desired, they turned their backs on him completely, turned their backs on God's salvation. But that's why Isaac writes in his song, his Christian hymn, let earth receive her king, because he is the king of the earth, and we need to not act like Israel. In Psalm 24, David writes about this king. He says in verse 8, 9 and 10, "Who is the King of glory? The Lord standing strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O gates, lift them up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory might come in. Who is the King of glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory." Oh, the Lord Almighty, the Word made flesh. He is the King of glory. So let earth receive her King. Don't be like faithless Israel, who rejected her King, so much so that they ended up murdering him. Rather, be like the Magi, those wise men from the East who weren't even Jewish, but yet understood the significance of who Jesus was. They understood the significance of Jesus' kingship, of his title. They understood the significance that he was the God-man, and as a result, they sought him out and they worshipped him. Jesus is the one born King of the Jews. And yet as the Messiah, as the King of the Jews, he's not just King of the Jews, he's King of all creation, all mankind. Thus, that makes Christmas a very exciting time. For us, Gentiles particularly. Because God has sent down his King. God has sent down our King, our salvation to us. So I implore you, as we will in a minute, sing the song, "Joy to the World," to sing it. Sing it with joy and understand it. Joy to the world, the Lord is come. Let earth receive her King. Let me pray.